Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Negotiations between NFL owners and players locked out NBA players making alternative career plans. Roger Clemens smiling at prospective jurors. Hey, is there any actual sports news this week? Maybe some baseball?
You know, once they get on a tear with a bat, it's like falling in love with a pair of shoes. You don't want to lose them.
We'll address broken bat syndrome, the science beyond the heartbreak. Also, hoops lifer Charlie Rosen on his crazy days in basketball and competitive kite flying in Bali. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Today is day 116 of the NFL lockout. That leaves 29 days until the annual Hall of Fame game, the start of the league's preseason schedule. For the past 2 days, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and the head of the Players Association, Demora Smith, have held negotiations in New York. Joining me now to discuss the latest in the ongoing labor dispute is Mike Reese, who covers the NFL for ESPNBoston.com. Mike, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
Yesterday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis threw out an earlier ruling that briefly ended the NFL lockout. The lockout was reinstated during the appeals process, so this really doesn't change much, does it?
It doesn't change much, and the most significant development from this was that the NFL and the NFL Players Association put out a joint statement saying that while they respect the court's decision, they are committed to negotiating, not litigating. And to me, that speaks to a very positive course of action toward an agreement, because certainly they weren't talking that way just a few months ago.
The negotiations over the past 2 days have been characterized as intense. There seems to be a growing sense the sides are perhaps getting closer to an agreement. Where do they stand on the main issue, which is revenue split?
Well, it's my understanding that they are in a very good place when it comes to the revenue split. In the past agreement, owners got $1 billion off the top before you even talked about a revenue split. So I think they've worked through that, and actually, that is a good sign for these sides coming together to an agreement, because that was considered the biggest issue of all.
Another issue being discussed is the structure of free agency in the league. One plan would allow NFL teams the right of first refusal on up to 3 players being courted by other teams. Do you expect that proposal to survive?
I don't expect that to survive. I think players fought so hard for free agency back in the early 1990s, and they're already restricted in some forms with the franchise tag that we often hear about and the transition tag. And I think they work so hard to get to free agency, I can't imagine that they would give that back to the owners, allowing them that right of first refusal.
Mike, this week a group of retired players sued both the current players and the owners, claiming that both sides were conspiring to cut the retirees' pensions and benefits. Do you have any sense of whether their concerns are justified?
Well, I think they are when you look at the past. I think when we've had the past labor disputes, oftentimes the needs of the retired players have been overlooked, because the owners are going to be looking out for the owners. The current players are going to be looking out for the current players. So who's looking out for the retired players? I think that is a significant issue to come to the forefront here as these talks sort of get to the goal line toward what appears to be a conclusion.
Yeah, I was wondering how long it would be before a football metaphor crept into the discussion. An NFL pioneer on and off the field, John Mackey, died this week. The Hall of Fame tight end for the Baltimore Colts was also the first president of the NFL Players Association. Later in life, he suffered from severe dementia, and his health care has been used as an example of the need for increased benefits for retired players. Do you think these negotiations will, in fact, lead to former players like Mackey being more fairly compensated?
I feel that they will, Bill, and I think that with John Mackey's death, it comes a spotlight shining on this issue. So I think when we look at this labor agreement and retired players and their place in it, I do think that they're going to come out better than before this started.
Mike, do you have a sense of what else the two sides are going to have to agree on to get this thing done?
I think a big part of it is going to be jurisdictional oversight. When this agreement is reached, what happens if the sides have a problem in the future? I think the players look at this and they would like to see a class action settlement where if this comes to be an issue again, that its oversight is in the court system, where I think ownership hasn't really liked that approach over the last two decades. They'd like to see sort of a strict arbitration system with no federal court oversight. So I think as we get to the end here, I think this is one of the big issues that the sides are working through.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear you use phrases like, as we get to the end. The Hall of Fame game is less than a month away, so will the St. Louis Rams and Chicago Bears play in Canton, Ohio on August 7th as scheduled?
I believe they will, Bill, and to me it comes down to the money, and I've said that from the start. I think that the sides have too good of a thing going, and when you consider that if the owners and players miss a week of preseason, that they'd be missing $200 to $250 million per week, I just can't imagine that being as far along as they are now in negotiations, that they won't strike that deal. So I think we will ultimately have football, and the discussion will turn to, is the quality of football as good as we remember it before this lockout happened?
Mike Reese covers the NFL for ESPNBoston.com. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Jury selection continued at the Roger Clemens perjury trial in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Some of the candidates didn't know who Clemens was, and at least one potential juror was excused for opining that corporate executives and politicians get away with lying to Congress all the time. The selection process is expected to last into the middle of next week. According to Associated Press legal correspondent Nedra Pickler, by midweek, Judge Reggie Walton had not determined whether former players who received performance-enhancing drugs from Clemens' former trainer, Brian McNamee, will be permitted to testify.
Yesterday, he said his tentative ruling is going to be that he's not going to allow those players to testify about the drugs that they took because it would unfairly prejudice the jury against Roger Clemens. However, this morning, he said he's thought about it overnight and he may change his mind.
The offspring of the bats Roger Clemens once broke with inside fastballs have also been breaking, and in recent years, that has become a safety issue. Shards from those bats have spun out over the field and flown into the stands. But the risks are declining thanks to a partnership between Major League Baseball and the U.S. Forest Service. Mitch Dyke of Milwaukee Public Radio reports.
The scene played out on a May evening at Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg, with a Rays David Price pitching to Grady Sizemore of the Indians.
And a broken bat, look out. The bat right back over Price. That ball fielded by Zobrist, and Zobrist throws out Sizemore. Wow, you talk about a couple close calls.
David Price was lucky. The head of the bat only grazed his head on its end-over-end trajectory towards center field. Bats have always broken, of course, but Major League Baseball didn't step in to do something until 2008. Dan Halem is baseball's senior vice president and general counsel for labor.
We had more bats breaking into two pieces and flying around the field and in some cases into the stands than in prior years. And it was an issue that was noticed by the media, by clubs, by players, and by the commissioner. And, you know, the commissioner wanted to do something about it very quickly.
In other words, the problem wasn't that bats were breaking at all. It was that bats were splintering. and it came about not long after maple bats came on the scene. But while baseball noticed that, the league wasn't equipped to figure out why the bats were breaking the way they were. So Hallam says they went looking for someone who could find the answer.
It's not that easy to find a wood scientist, so we did the easy thing. We called the federal government, you know, really to try to get a recommendation. And lo and behold, the Forest Service's Forest Products Laboratory said, we'll help you.
The lab is actually a campus of buildings in the heart of Madison, Wisconsin. Inside an imposing granite edifice, Dave Kretschmann has about 24 baseball bats spread out on rolling carts and a conference table. Correction, 24 broken bats.
I've been here for about 25 years. Our laboratory itself has been around for 100 years, so it's we know wood, and wood is good, as we say around here.
Kretschmann is a research general engineer with the Forest Products Lab. He heads the team Major League Baseball put together to look into why bats were splintering, or as he describes it, having multiple piece failures.
It comes down to the fact that the pitch is a very fast pitch, very strong players, and wood can only take so much loading before it actually breaks. That's just the nature of any material, actually. You can load any material to failure. Bats will break, but what your goal is to keep them in one piece rather than have them separate and enter the field of play or go out into the stands.
So Kretschmann and his team looked at broken bats, a lot of them. Every bat that was broken in the major leagues between July and September of 2008 came through his lab. And for a wood scientist, one key issue quickly became apparent, something called slope of grain. To explain, Kretschmann says to imagine the handle of a bat as a bunch of drinking straws.
It's strongest if the straws are going right up and down the barrel of the bat. But as they start to tip over to the side, wood is much weaker when it's loaded perpendicular to the grain or has a slope of grain in that handle. And so one of the things that you could really see when you spread all these bats out was that there was an issue with slope of grain in the handles of the bats that were breaking into multiple pieces.
Kretschmann says that was good because it could be addressed easily by having bat manufacturers pay closer attention to slope of grain. And that's what baseball required of the 30 companies that make bats used at the major league level. Since 2009, the number of multiple-piece failures has dropped by half. But there is another part of the equation, geometry. Handles are smaller, barrels larger, and bats less dense than they used to be. That is apparent underneath the stands at Fox City Stadium in Appleton, Wisconsin, where the Class A Wisconsin Timber Rattlers are taking batting practice. Most of these players are not far removed from using metal bats in college, and hitting coach Dusty Rhodes says they're looking for any advantage they can get, which means light bats and big barrels.
They got to get a bat they can use. They got to be able to handle it because they have to be able to adjust when you have two strikes. So it's a difference in mental part of it and physical part of it. They've got to learn how to hit the ball in the sweet spot of a wooden bat, which is kind of tough sometimes.
And it's not likely to change, even when bat safety is figured in. Rhodes says regardless of the level, players believe the best bat is the one with a lot of hits in it.
It's happened a lot of times in the big leagues where a guy will break a bat and doesn't have an extra bat sometimes. And somebody lets a guy borrow a bat, next thing you know, he goes on a tear with that bat, so he changes bats. You know, once they get on a tear with a bat, it's like falling in love with a pair of shoes. You don't want to lose them.
That means in ballparks in Wisconsin and around professional baseball, some of the timber will go on rattling into the foreseeable future. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Appleton, Wisconsin.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. When you win, you celebrate. And when you win the French Open golf tournament, you celebrate by jumping into a lake and breaking your leg, thereby removing yourself from the British Open. Oh, wait, that's not right. You celebrate in some way that does not place any of your bones in jeopardy, and you proceed to the British Open filled with the confidence you've gained by winning the French. Yeah, that's the ticket. Or so Thomas Levitt, who won the French Open and then jumped into a lake to celebrate and broke his leg, must be thinking. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Rosen, author of the new book Crazy Basketball Gets Crazy over, well, basketball. Yesterday, the Houston Chronicle and Yahoo Sports reported that Rocket center Yao Ming will retire after 9 seasons in the NBA. Injuries forced the 7-foot-6-inch former star to miss all but 5 games over the past 2 seasons. Yao might not be the only player sitting it out this fall. The NBA lockout is in its 2nd week, and the league and its players' union appear to be digging in for a long fight. But some of the league's stars, including Kobe Bryant, are already making plans to play overseas if the lockout extends into the NBA season. The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay has a better idea. Jason, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you. In a column this week, you presented your, quote, inventive 101% genius alternative to the NBA lockout. Nothing modest there. Could you quickly sum up what you think players should do instead of taking their talents overseas?
Well, why not, you know, at least for a certain part of the fall, if there is a lockout, put together an all-star team of NBA players and barnstorm the United States. Football players did it back before the NFL. Babe Ruth did it. Satchel Paige did it. Why not do it with these NBA players?
Your dream barnstorming roster includes Charles Barkley. Sir Charles seems like the only guy on your roster who might actually go for this idea. Have you called him up and asked him to join?
Well, I'm going to wait for Charles to, you know, get on the elliptical trainer a little bit before we, you know, propose a specific start date. But, you know, considering Charles has made a living in the last decade of making fun of the, you know, qualities of NBA players, wouldn't it be great to get him out there mixing up with the guys he's constantly critiquing?
All right. Your plan has 10 rules, starting with it's all free and ending with scoring rules that favor the home team 10-1 against the NBA All-Stars. Do you have a favorite among the other 8 rules of your barnstorming league?
Yes, I do have a favorite. I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to give you 2 things. One is I think it's very important that they're riding around a yellow school bus. I don't care what they do to the interior of the school bus, but I want these 15 NBA All-Stars on a school bus singing campfire song. And then the second thing is no hotels, no beds and breakfast. I want these people crashing on the couches and in the guest rooms of the places that they're staying. So that means that we need a host for LeBron. We need a host for Dirk Nowitzki. We need someone to put Jason Kidd in a bed. You know, we need people there in the morning having breakfast with these players. You know, we're not going fancy VIP here.
Who has a futon long enough for LeBron, let alone Dirk Nowitzki?
That's a very good question. I think that what you need to do is you get the futon, then you get the ottoman, and then maybe you get the family dog. And you pull them all out consecutively, and I think we'll be fine for Dirk.
In all seriousness, Kobe Bryant is planning a barnstorming tour of China, not of suburban high school gyms. And Deron Williams has apparently signed a deal to play in Turkey in the event of a lingering lockout. Do you expect that this lockout is going to last long enough for those plans to come to fruition?
Well, it's hard to say here sitting in July how long this lockout, you know, is going to last. We've seen, obviously, with the NFL that this has dragged on quite a bit with them. NBA players, unlike NFL players, have quite a bit of options around the world. But I think that they're all in the business right now of looking into these alternatives, and, you know, they do have choices.
Your column points out how disconnected the NBA has become from the average fan and the average fan's life. He can't even afford to attend a game if he could, would constantly have his attention pried from the action by the court flashing advertising.
Not to mention the T-shirt guns.
Yeah, the T-shirt guns shooting T-shirts at you with a little cannon there. I know you're a dreamer, Jason, so can we dream that the NBA will return from this lockout with lower ticket prices, less corporate nonsense?
Well, that would certainly be a really great goal. I mean, I think we saw it a little bit in the NHL. There was some price restructuring that happened when they returned from a terrible work stoppage. It would be a really good goal for the NBA to have, because I think we're all in agreement that, you know, for a great many basketball fans, that an average NBA game has become way too overpriced. And, you know, it affects the atmosphere. We saw a lot of complaints during the playoff season, particularly in places like Miami, where, you know, arenas where you had massive playoff games were quieter than golf games because people were just there to have a good time and sit in the VIP seats and go back to the corporate suites.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Jason, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Charlie Rosen is a basketball man, or at least he has been. Toward the end of his new book, Crazy Basketball, he writes, quote, "Nowadays, I only touch a basketball once every year, so maybe he's best characterized as a recovering basketball man. But he was a college player, and for years he coached under some seriously bizarre circumstances in the now-defunct Continental Basketball Association. The stories from those days and others fill Crazy Basketball, and Charlie Rosen joins me now from WAMC in Albany, New York, to tell some of them. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Happy to be back.
Some of the memories from your early basketball days involve the players from the Eastern League, many of whom had been involved in college basketball's betting scandals back in the 50s. You write that as a young man, you were, and I'm quoting now, stunned by the total lack of joy with which they played. Was this because basketball was all about joy for you?
When I was 18 years old, it was. And then to encounter these guys who were so good, down to the tiniest nuance, and they just played without smiles. It was stunning, as you mentioned, but it was also very sad and very puzzling.
One story from your Eastern League days involves a player named Dick Gaines of the Scranton Miners, whom you describe, and I'm quoting again, as a marginal criminal type. At least once, Mr. Gaines convinced an opponent named George Blaney to refrain from having a second great game against the Miners. How did he do that?
He threatened him with a gun. And he indeed did have a gun. I saw it in his bag. And I had known Blaney. I had played against him a couple of times during the summer. And he came over to me after the first game, in which Blaney played very well against Gaines. I said, "Hey, Charlie, this guy threatened me with a gun. What should I do?" I said, "If I were you, I'd step on the brakes, because he has a gun. Indeed, he does, and who knows what he will do." And that scared George enough to impair his play in the second game.
He shot something like 2 for 19 in the second game.
Right.
You worked as an assistant coach under Phil Jackson in the Continental Basketball Association, and there you found that it's fairly common for CBA players to simply vanish, or so you wrote. Can you give me an example or two?
Well, there was one player when I coached in Albany, Albany Patroons. He had a habit of vanishing. What he would do is borrow money from people while he was on the team and then disappear, and totally disappear for like a year. And I eventually hooked up with this guy who had played in the NBA for a little bit and made a trade for him, and he was a great player. We went on a winning streak, and I thought we really had a chance to win a championship. And then one day he didn't show up to practice. Nobody knew where he had gone to, and I haven't heard from him since.
Eventually, you became a head coach in the CBA. You ran the Patroons for a time, and then the Rockford Lightning, the Oklahoma City Cavalry, and the Savannah Spirits. But you were told by the owner of the Spirits that you weren't, quote, sufficiently heartless to succeed in the coaching business. What led him to that conclusion?
Well, he was in Detroit. He was centered in Detroit, and he had someone drive him, actually, to Savannah just to check up on the organization and really to supply a transfusion to the front office. They were running out of money fast, and he brought a player with him. And I forgot his name, but the player he brought was a great defensive player, incredible defensive player. But he had kind of a mean-eyed, inner-city look about him. And to put him on the team, I would have had to cut a young man who had played at the Citadel, and I really liked. He was just a nice fellow. He played pretty good defense. He had an on-and-off jump shot. Reagan Truesdale was his name, and he was yes, sir, and yes, sir. And he just helped the chemistry of the team so much that I couldn't bear it. Even though the guy brought from Detroit was a better player, I just didn't have the heart to send this guy home and just add another guy on the team who may have disrupted that chemistry. So I refused, and that's when the owner told me that I didn't have what it took to make it. He was right.
Well, you held on for a number of years despite
that,
though.
Well, there was nothing else I could figure out to do.
There were a lot of frustrating nights in the CBA, but only one of them landed you in jail. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, I knew you'd bring that up. Well, it's a long story, but the short version, Eric Musselman was coaching. He later coached in the NBA. He called me up. He said he had just played a game in Cedar Rapids, and the coach there put a full court trap on with like a minute left to go, and his team ahead by 20 points. Would I speak to him about it? So I did. He said, no, I don't do that. I never do anything like that. He's wrong. Okay. So we play the game. We're competitive for the first three quarters. We get blown out in the fourth quarter, which irritated me anyway. And the same thing happened. He's up about 15, 20 points with a minute left to go. And he calls out red, and he put a full court press on. So I got up and screamed down at him, what are you doing? And he cursed me and said, if you don't like it, come on down here and do something about it. So I did. I went down there and tried to get at him, but one of the referees grabbed me and pulled me away. Of course, I was thrown out of the game. So I'm in the locker room fuming at the owner, at the game, at the other coach. I had a lot of things to be mad about. And I decided to go out into the hallway to get a drink. And the game happened to be over. And there was the other coach preening in front of the media, saying what a hothead I was and blah, blah, blah. And I should stick to writing poetry, of all things. So I ran at him and took a couple of wild swings, which didn't connect. The cop appeared out of nowhere, threw me to the ground, put his knee on my chest, and my players surrounded him at the time. Like, hey, you know, leave him alone, leave him alone. And this little white cop kind of looked up and saw these, you know, 6'9", 6'10", black guys circling him, and he reached for his gun. So that set me off again. You know, who are you going to shoot? How many bullets you have? You going to shoot all of us? So he kind of let us go, went into the locker room. 10 minutes later, a riot squad came, pulled me out, threw me up against the wall, beat me with the batons in my legs, took me to jail, booked me, and I spent about 3 hours there. My players pooled their money to bail me out. They had a meal waiting for me, and they all told me about the times that they were in jail and were very happy that I had stood up for them.
You write that in the CBA, anybody could be traded for anything. Keeping in mind that this is a family show, tell us a little more about some of the league's stranger trades.
Well, one player was traded for a sex act to be performed later.
Well, that was nicely done. I think that's okay,
even on
a family show. Good for you.
One trade happened because a team in Wyoming had this halftime stunt where they brought a car out to center court, opened the sunroof. You could make a paper airplane out of the program, come to half court, and throw the paper airplane. If it landed in the car, you won the car. The dealer who supplied the car said it was impossible to do. They monkeyed around with the fans in the arena to discourage that, but one guy succeeded, and they had to give him the car. And it cost the franchise, the Wyoming Wildcatters in Casper, Wyoming, it cost them $6,000, which they didn't have. So they traded their best player to me for $6,000. So basically a paper airplane was the impetus for that particular trade.
At least once, if I read this book properly, it seems to me that you traded a player in order to get rid of that player's wife. Have I got that right?
Oh, yeah. I won't mention his name, but he played in the Big Ten, and he broke a finger in training camp. And he did nothing to stay in shape. He didn't run laps. He didn't even come to practice. And when the season started, he was ready to play. But I didn't play him, and he had been a starter the year before when someone else coached the team. So I just thought I'd kind of feed him in and play him 4 minutes or 5 minutes until he got into the swing of things. And after the very first game when he didn't start and only played a couple of minutes, his wife just jumped me after the game and started screaming curses at me. And how could I do this? So I just got on the phone and immediately traded him.
It must be nice to have that kind of power.
Well, yeah, you know, that's the one advantage that the CBA had over the NBA. The NBA, you have to worry about no-cut contracts and equitable salaries. And college, you can't trade anybody. So the CBA was really, really good for that.
Charlie, I won't ask if you miss the late lamented CBA, but do you miss basketball?
Let's see. Well, I certainly miss it now that there's no NBA season. I miss that. I miss playing, and I don't miss playing. I miss being 20 years old and playing, that's for sure. I don't miss playing in my later years. I played till I was 52, 53, when the only times that I was pain-free was when I was playing basketball. It did take me a while to feel comfortable not playing. But I also realized that I was never really talented, but I was big and strong, and I could shoot, and I could do a couple of things. I could set a great moving pick, terrific moving pick.
Which is, of course, illegal.
Of course. Not in the Bronx, though. Not where I grew up in the Bronx, it isn't. So I miss the camaraderie. I miss the freedom, the flow of the game. I miss that. And every time I heard a ball bounce for a couple of years, I kind of got a heart pang. But now I don't miss it at all.
Charlie Rosen is the author of lots of books having to do with basketball, the most recent of which is Crazy Basketball, A Life in and Out of Bounds, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He spoke with me from WAMC in Albany. Charlie, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, again, thank you very much for asking me to join.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Ah, the music swells, and on to the previously empty stage come the dancers, spinning and twirling, doing things of that nature. I can hardly wait to see them. But, oh, perhaps I'll have to wait, because, like the NFL football players and the NBA basketball players, the Joffrey Ballet dancers are facing a lockout. The ballet's contract with the American Guild of Musical Artists expired Thursday night, and the ballet company, fearing a strike, has told the dancers they should clear out their lockers. One assumes that they will do that with grace, of course, and that if the dancers ever do walk, it will be the most elegant strike in the history of organized labor. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll hear about some people who've gone and flown a kite, or a lot of kites, competitively. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Hall of Fame manager Dick Williams died this week at the age of 82. He was one of only two managers to lead three teams to the World Series. Do you have a favorite memory to share?
Well, everybody's favorite memory in Boston is the fact that he led the Red Sox to the World Series in 1967. It is still to this day unimaginable that the team that finished the way that team did at the end of 1966 made it to the seventh game of the World Series the following year. He went on to bigger success with better lineups, but I'll always remember the tough-minded guy who took over the Red Sox and said simply that the team was going to win more games than it would lose. And I'll never forget the ongoing dialogue between him and the great George Boomer Scott, which ended up with George the Boomer Scott saying, "He called me a cement head."
The perjury trial of Roger Clemens got underway in Washington, D.C. this week, or at least the jury selection did. Prospective jurors were asked how much they knew about baseball. Do you suppose Defendant Clemens was surprised that at least some of those questioned did not know who he was?
I think amicus curiae brief Bud Selig was a little bit surprised by that, too, and a little bit alarmed, I would think. This is an ongoing farce. Our great national steroid hunt has come down to a bunch of perjury traps set to trap the clever and deft mind of baseball players in clever webs of words. I mean, forgive me if I'm not too impressed by this whole thing.
Derek Jeter is just two away from joining baseball's 3,000-hit club, Charlie. As he approaches that magic number, there are reports that the only ones enjoying Jeter's chase are the fans. When did hitting a ball safely 3,000 times become such a chore?
Well, it gets to be a chore when you're Derek Jeter's age and you have to grind it out every day. It also can weigh on your teammates, although people have generally been a little bit less vocal about their dissatisfaction with these kind of milestone events than Joe Girardi was this week, who said, "We're going to try to wrap this up this weekend." Thanks, Joe. I mean, me and baseball history would like to thank you for being so enthusiastic about your work.
Football Hall of Famer John Mackey died this week. The ex-Baltimore Colt and first president of the Players Association suffered from dementia, and his health care became a defining case in the fight to secure benefits for retired players. Mackey's death comes just days after the retired players filed a suit saying owners and current players are now trying to limit those benefits. One hopes all involved will honor Mackey's memory better than that, don't you think?
Yeah, one hopes that both sides will realize what a public relations disaster this will be. And if they don't, one hopes that the retired player's lawsuit succeeds.
Former Giants quarterback Kerry Collins retired this week. Charlie, I don't know about you, but when I retire, I really hope the headline announcing same does not include the word GOAT.
Well, I don't think they will certainly refer to Super Bowl GOAT because
you will never
be within 100 miles of a Super Bowl. Yeah, he had a bad game in Super Bowl 35 and was intercepted four times by the Baltimore Ravens and lost. I mean, he did play 16 seasons. You would think that, you know, perhaps we could do a little bit better for a farewell than that.
Last week, you picked the U.S., which plays Brazil tomorrow in the Women's World Cup quarterfinals, to win the tournament. On Wednesday, they lost to Sweden 2-1. You prepared to waffle?
Why do you hate America? Why do you hate America, Bill? Our girls will rise from the turf of Germany and put that obvious refereeing thievery behind them and eventually defeat the plucky Swedes when it matters the most. Because I am on the side of our girls, especially Napoleon Solo's daughter, Hope.
Is this where I get to say, "Drat, they're on to me"? The 2011 Tour de France is a week old, Charlie, and has lost a number of potential yellow jersey winners. British hopeful Bradley Wiggins crashed out yesterday. Former world champion Tom Boonen of Belgium and Radio Shack leader Jane Brakovich have also crashed out. I suppose this is better than crashing out because you tested positive
for
something.
I was about to say, there's no question it's gotten much too dangerous. It's time to put the drugs back in this race.
The International Olympic Committee announced this week that Pyeongchang, South Korea, will be the site of the 2018 Winter Games. And I guess the message from the IOC was, keep trying, and you will get picked.
Yeah, they kept getting passed over by everybody. I was there for the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul. They proved themselves. The one thing that you must prove if you're going to host the Olympics is, are you willing to hand almost your entire society over to the corrupt International Olympic Committee for 16 days? The Koreans were more than willing to do that in 1988. And finally, they've been rewarded with the Winter Games. I guarantee you, by the way, that everything will be cleared up by 2018, so people will not refer to the host city as Pyongyang, which is really
it's
not where,
the other side
where
of the border.
Really where you don't want to go.
Charlie, we lost a friend this week.
Yes.
George Kimball, late of the Boston Herald and the Boston Phoenix, died on Thursday. He was a recent guest on this show, but you knew George much better than I. Have you a particular story about him that you can share?
Well, he was instrumental in my coming to the Phoenix, which was instrumental in my having a career at all. The one thing I do remember most about George from the Phoenix days is that one of our other staffers had a Siberian Husky who was someplace between 60 and 400 years old, and the dog would sleep in the middle of the newsroom until George got off the elevator, and then the dog would go, Nobody could figure out how he knew that Kimball disliked dogs as much as George did. I mean, there are too many stories. He drank beer, smoked unfiltered Luckies, and was a strict vegetarian. He was wild. He was profane. He was a lot of fun, and he was an absolute old mate on the golf course. There aren't many people you can legitimately say were larger than life, much less the life he led, but he was.
and a superb writer and a real appreciator of superb writing when other people did it.
Yeah, and the last true fan boxing had, and one that boxing did not deserve.
This week, a spokesman at Auburn University said, "I don't want to give a sense of false hope, but we're not ready to say they're definitely not going to make it." Isn't it a little early to be that negative about the football team?
No. It's the trees, the poison trees at Toomer's Corner. I think myself they've been injecting it with the lemonade from the pharmacy at Toomer's Corner, which I will tell you is the greatest lemonade made anywhere on this planet by anyone ever. It is absolutely the Chateau Petrus of lemonade, and it will heal you if you're sick. And I think they've been injecting it into the trees myself.
And finally, Charlie, Dallas Cowboys receiver Roy Williams wanted to make his engagement special, and so, of course, he chose to send his girlfriend a $76,000 ring in the mail. I assume this all worked out exactly as planned.
Love, exciting and new. Yeah, he wanted the ring back when she turned him down, and now he's suing to get it back. I personally think that the romance has gone out of football, Bill. I don't know about you.
Charlie Pierce is the author of several books, among them Idiot America. What kind of idiot do you have to be to propose via the U.S. mail? Anyway, Charlie joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you,
Could
Charlie.
Be a new chapter.
The Women's World Cup quarterfinals begin today. The Germans are defending champions as well as hosts, and they won all three of their group stage games. Among the eliminated teams are New Zealand, North Korea, and Colombia, all of which earned just 1 point, and Canada and Equatorial Guinea, which earned none.
In days of not so old, remember, you could always say that Norway, China, or the team here in the USA would win the Women's Cup for sure. The others would look on as form prevailed without surprise. But now those days are gone. The Germans drew the fans, of course. Brazil's been known to dance. But who'd have figured one team winning two would be from France?
The French team finished a strong second in Group A, and they've scored as many goals, 7, as host Germany and Brazil, both of which finished group play undefeated.
Old England started poorly, unless you're from Mexico. The two teams drew, but England won their next two games, and so the English meet the French today. Ah, shades of Agincourt. That's history. I know, and I should stick to sport.
Yes, you should. In what will be a less dramatic quarterfinal, if favored Germany has anything to say about it, the host team will meet Japan. The U.S. team had never lost a group stage match in any World Cup until Sweden beat them on Wednesday. As a result of finishing second to Sweden in Group C, the U.S. must play Brazil tomorrow, by which time U.S. coach Pia Sundhage must hope that her team will have gotten faster, or that the Brazilians will have gotten older, slower, and less imaginative. Sweden.
In times like these, I wonder if I should depend on rhyme. It is, I fear, for U.S. fans, a scary sort of time. If Marta cannot be contained except by fouls and punches, Brazil, like Sweden, may prevail by scoring goals in bunches.
Even a small bunch might be sufficient against a U.S. team that could only manage one goal on Wednesday and 5 total against North Korea and Colombia, both of which have been eliminated. Sweden, meanwhile, will face Australia in tomorrow's other quarterfinal match.
Brazil has never won the cup. The Germans have won twice. If England or Australia won, it might be kind of nice. The Swedes can't be discounted, and Japan has played quite well. And if the U.S. should prevail, well, sure, that would be swell. In any case, the days are gone when just a couple teams could bear with valid confidence a country's soccer dreams.
The four teams that survive this weekend's matches will play in the semifinals on Wednesday. The championship will be decided in Frankfurt on Sunday, July 17th.
In the Balinese summertime, when the easterly winds are blowing in from the sea, the sky above the island is dotted with kites of all shapes and sizes. For the Balinese, kiting is both a spiritual activity and a sport. Maria Bacalopolo finds out more.
From June to August, when winds are strong across southern Bali, The sky fills up with small and large kites of all colors. For the Balinese, kiting is a serious activity. A half an hour drive from Kuta, Bali's tourist Mecca, traffic is brought to a halt as kites the size of barn doors are brought down busy roads for Bali's International Kite Festival. For 33 years, entire villages, or banjars, have competed in this event. The truckloads of teams arrive, each accompanied by their own gamelan orchestra, serving the role of cheerleaders for the ultimate test of skills in kite construction and flying. Ranging in size from 6 to 15 feet, the designs are strictly categorized in shapes symbolizing fish, dragons, and turtles derived from Hindu mythology. Those who take part must prepare months in advance, says Nioman Adiana, one of the founding members of the competition.
This needs a long time.
All made by hand?
Yes, more by hand. When we start to build a kite, it's special.
Every year the festival grows, with attendances around the 10,000 mark, and so do the sizes of the kites, some with tails as long as 300 feet.
It's a good day to fly a kite?
Yes, the wind is strong and stable.
Ketut Winanta has been making winning kites for the past 5 years.
This is a traditional fish kite. This one already has won many competitions. Now I'm fixing it.
Is it important for you to win the competition?
It's very important. It's challenging to make a better and better kite. It makes me feel proud, and I do win money sometimes. The measurements have to be precise to pass the judges' scrutiny. I have my own system to make a winning kite. The bamboo frame is tensioned with fishing line. The wingspan should be half the length of the body.
Along with sport, it is also very much about Hindu faith and the Balinese's deeply rooted connection to an agrarian lifestyle. Nioman Adiana tells us more while at a kite competition.
The Balinese, they believe what we call Rareangon. Rareangon means the god of the kite, you know. And the people fly the kite after the harvest day, usually. And after they cut the rice, they start to fly the kite. The kite, not only what you have seen on the air, but they have mean also, thanks to the god, they get prosperous to the people.
The Balinese also feel the kites have spirits, so a special range of fabric colors are used for their kites to symbolize the gods, with red for Brahma, the creator, white for Vishnu, the god that maintains and looks after the universe, and black for Shiva, the destroyer. Before the kite can be constructed, a priest is consulted to find the right day to cut the bamboo and the material to build the kite. Once the kite is ready to take air, the banjar organizes a temple ceremony to bless the kite with offerings made to the gods to ensure a successful flight. On the day of the competition, village teams, 20 to 40 men of all ages, work together to hoist the kite up and keep it under control. The Balinese competition is a riot of color, music, frantic teamwork, and it requires a large degree of physical strength. Younger and younger kite flyers are taking up the sport. I met up with 23-year-old Made, kite leader from the village of Kesimen, at a gamelan practice.
We have around 250 people from our group who join in the kite competition. Everyone joins, even kids and their parents. Around 30 to 40 people actually fly the one kite. We have three people holding the string of the kite while the others release it into the air. We don't learn how to do it necessarily. It's instinctual.
And so the judges sit from dawn until dusk, watching as categories of 10 to 15 kites fly in rounds. A commentator chants over the PA, asking for a strong wind to come in and help the kites dance in the wind. the spectators all look to the sky and over the intense gamelan music and the crowd cheering. You can hear the hummers of the kites vibrating in the wind. The sound to the Balinese means harmony, the kites singing for the god's pleasure. Kite flying here is more than a competition. It's truly a national pastime. In Bali, people of all ages, from gas station attendants on busy roads to children playing in the rice fields, can find time to fly a kite. For Only a Game, I'm Maria Bakalopoulou.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Allison Gluck. We had help this week from Stacy Perry at WAMC in Albany and from Peter Lydotes. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see photos from Mitch Tyke's bat story or Maria Bakalopoulou's piece about kite flying in Bali, read my review of Crazy Basketball, or revisit stories past or present, please visit onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from the late George Kimball. Nobody appreciated boxing more or wrote more eloquently about it.
Old baseball players like to get together and talk over old times, but I don't think they have the uncommon respect for one another that old boxers do, particularly ones who have fought each other.
With respect and admiration, rest in peace, George. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.